Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with director, writer, actor, and magician Paul Feig. Paul Feig has an uncanny ability to reflect humanity, as evidenced in the cringeworthy and torturous moments of adolescence in the cult television show Freaks and Geeks, and in his female-centric hit comedies, Bridesmaids and Spy. His characters are honest and realistic, in addition to hilarious. And Paul's at it again with his newest foray into the art of self-examination in A Simple Favor, a film starring Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively that examines the unsettling, dark underpinnings of friendship, marriage, and mommy vlogs. A self-described gentle giant, Paul was an overly sensitive kid growing up, making him an attractive candidate for bullying. As Paul says, when someone says the phrase locker room talk, all I hear is me getting tortured. I don't know why there aren't laws against kids taking showers at school. But Paul's sensitivity was also a blessing. It made him a better writer and performer, two things he always wanted to be. Luckily, being on stage, even if he was brandishing an amateur magic kit, was one of the few places where Paul felt appreciated as a teenager. As he says, I used to do my magic act at retirement homes. That's the circuit when you're a young teen magician. I'd been so tortured in high school, the only time I ever felt lauded or admired was when I was on stage. Well, with that little bit of positive reinforcement, Paul decided to strike out for Hollywood. He took an initial 20-year detour as an actor, but eventually found his way to writing and directing after a particularly inspiring conversation with director John Landis. Paul walked out of that conversation thinking, I want to be that guy. I want to be a director. And we're all the better off for it. Paul joins off camera to talk about the humiliating moment that led him to give up acting in favor of directing, the key to making a successful comedy, and why he hates questions that start with why. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
Good. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. I never look better than when I'm in black and white.
That's why we're in black and white.
Thank you.
We can look good and like young, virile men.
I love it. I don't look like I have a drinking problem. My rosacea's gone.
Exactly. No, we can see the red nose.
That's right. The gin blossoms, yeah. they disappear into a beautiful field.
Well, listen, I love your films and loved Freaks and Geeks because I had a pretty tough childhood, pretty tough adolescence, as many people do. Mm-hmm. But also, at the time of Freaks and Geeks, those were stories or the way they were told, the realities that were presented, were not only funny, but really true representations of people that we know. And, you know, if you're a very young person now, I think you take a lot of that for granted, that wasn't a given that you were going to see that in a medium of television or film.
Totally. When I created Freaks and Geeks, I wanted to make something about my high school experience, you know, because I didn't see myself and my group being portrayed realistically on TV and in films.
I think a lot of people would look at that and go, oh, those aren't the kind of stories that are being told, so I'll fit in with... Like, what do you think gave you that confidence?
Well, so I always kind of lament these days. I always go, like, the more you get into the business, you know too much. Like, I just didn't know anything back then. So, I would watch all these, you know, really fun movies, you know, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, these kind of things. But I was like, but these aren't about the people I knew. They're all kind of obsessed with having sex, and they're having sex, and it's all about kind of the issues with that. And then you watch these kind of teen soap operas would be on, even though they weren't portrayed by teens. They're usually people well into their 20s. But it was so much about the dynamics of sexuality and dating and, you know, and soapy kind of stuff. And
kids just wanted to be adults.
Yeah, totally. You know, and it's a fantasy fulfillment, and I understand that. But for me, I would just watch and go like, that was not my experience at all. And all my friends, we were just kind of nerdy, and you know, because we were the outcasts, because we weren't cool. And so it was, you know, we were on the fringes. And I just really felt like, why don't I see that? Why don't I see that group? Because there has to be more people than me that went through that. And so, yeah, so when I created Freaks and Geeks, I was just like, well, who wouldn't want to watch something about the worst parts of their childhood and the, you know, the awkward kids? And, you know, we got made, and you know, critics loved it, and we had a loyal fan base, but we were like the lowest rated show on NBC at the time, because it was just, it was not fantasy fulfillment whatsoever. It was literally the deconstruction of fantasy and shoving your horrible past in your face for comedy. And I thought, well, what could be more cathartic than that? And it turned out people just didn't, they didn't want to deal with it
yeah.
at all.
Yeah.
And so the minute I kind of knew we were cooked is when we did this one episode about where Nick, you know, Jason Segel goes to audition yeah. for his favorite band, Dimension, and he's going to play the drums, and, you know, and it falls apart, and I just thought it was fantastic. And so I'm talking to some critic who was really supportive of us, and I said, like, oh, what'd you think about that scene? He's like, you know what? He walked in that audition, and I had to leave the room, and I couldn't watch that scene because I knew it was going to go bad. And I was like, oh, well, no, but you're supposed to have fun watching it go bad. And then you're like, oh, gosh, I think actually people don't want to relive those terrible times. At least back then they didn't. I mean, what's ironic now is, you know, we're much more, you know, TV's much more kind of cringy and honest and dramatic in that way that it wasn't back then. It was just we kind of came in at the wrong time, because the minute we came in, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was the biggest show on TV. I mean, just a juggernaut. It took everybody else down. And so the networks at that time were going like, well, you know, we got these game shows that cost a fraction of what these scripted shows cost, and it just was too much money for what we were doing ratings-wise, which we were, at the most of our run, we were the bottom or close to the bottom rated show on NBC.
So you also wrote a memoir, Kick Me, which I read this week, which I loved, and I was curious about the timeline of creating Freaks and Geeks and writing that memoir. Was this a period in your life where you were like, I'm going to tell this story of me, and it's going to resonate, and it's going to be this cathartic experience?
Yeah.
Was that part of your education to yourself?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a weird thing. You know, I always wanted to be a writer, and I was always writing since I was in high school, and also, you know, wanted to be a performer. I was performing forever, and, you know, so I always wanted to do that. My goal was back then to be Woody Allen. I was like, oh, I can write and direct and star in my own stuff. So that's kind of my way to tell my take on the world. Like, oh, I got to write movie scripts because that's, you know, how you get to making your own thing that you star in.
And what age are you at this point?
I was like 15, I guess.
Okay.
And I had in my head that a real writer writes completely out of thin air.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, well, you can't base stuff on your life because then that's cheating. So I spent years writing, you know, like sci-fi and you know, these other kind of genres that it's fine, and I still like to write those things, but it was all about like, oh, I have to just kind of make this up out of nowhere. So I can't have a character that's based on me, and I can't have it based on people I know. I just have to kind of, you know, freeform this. And it was just, it didn't connect. That it was fine writing, but just didn't connect. And people were like, yeah, okay, it's fine, it's fine.
I wonder how that ties in with your own self-image at the time of like,
yeah,
you know, would anyone find this stuff interesting?
I think, that's a good point, because I think I'd been so kind of tortured in high school and, you know, just as an adolescence. The only time I ever kind of was lauded or admired, quote unquote, was when I was up on stage. You know, I was a magician when I was a young teen, and I wanted to enter the talent show. And so I used to do my magic act at retirement homes and nursing homes and all that kind of thing. That's the circuit when you're a young teen magician.
So your parents would drive you around to nursing homes?
My mom would, yeah, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was ridiculous. I mean, when I first started out, I had a magic kit that had these tricks that were so tiny. And I remember, like, I mean, standing at the front of this enormous room with all these, you know, really old people. I had like one trick that was two dice that were literally this big, and it's like if you flip it this way, they change. So I'm up there going like this.
A bunch of people in their 70s that can't see.
Oh no,
anyway.
They're just smiling, and I'm going, I'm killing, and they're like, oh no, they're just like, oh how cute, there's a kid here, and we don't know what the hell he's doing, but we'll admire him. So so I think I just had this feeling in my head of like, from just being beaten down, that like, oh, whenever I'm not myself, people seem to be entertained. Because, yeah, I told my dad, I'm going to be in the talent show. And he's like, well, you got to have some jokes in there. I mean, you're just going to bore people if you just do those tricks. So he gave me all these old nightclub jokes from the 50s. And so I went up on stage and did this act with telling these really old, corny, fairly off-color jokes as a freshman. And I won the talent show, you know. And it was the greatest victory of my life. I mean, literally, I had gone from just being with bullies and all this to like killing on stage and then winning, beating out like these really good singers and stuff.
I was going to mention that story out of the book because you also described how it was the first time you and your dad did something more on a friend level than him just being the authoritarian in your house.
Yeah, I was always kind of afraid of my dad, and it, for no reason. I mean, he was a really nice guy, but he owned an army surplus store. And, you know, he just worked constantly. I mean, he was just always at work, and he would always come home late. And so my mom and I were like compatriots. And my dad was just very judgmental. Like, all you ever heard him say, like, oh, for God's sakes, why? Oh, for God's sake. Like, he'd get mad about something, or if I, you know, didn't do something he wanted me to do, he'd kind of get, he'd explode, but not in a way where he'd come at me. He would just, like, start yelling. I remember once, such a horrible moment, where, you know, I was kind of like this drifty kid or whatever, and he was kind of late for work, and I was supposed to go to work with him. You got to make a sandwich, and, you know, by the time I'm done, we got to leave. And so he's fumfering around, and I get completely distracted by something out the window. I think it was a bird doing something, and I was just, like, staring, and he comes and goes, "Do you have your lunch?" And I was like, "Oh, no, I didn't do it yet." And he just, like, he lost it. He's just like, "God damn it!" And I heard him, like, go back into, like, his room or something, and I hear, like, literally, like, he's throwing things and, like, punching the door. And he's like, and I swear I thought I heard him say, "I hate that kid." I don't know if he said it, but in my head, it was just like, I remember sitting, like, numb with fear, like, trying to make this sandwich and, like, oh, my God. But he was just, he had this kind of temper that would come out occasionally. And he was also a boss, and I don't think he ever loved being a boss, you know, because, right, you know, working at the store, but he's like having fun and laughing, and, you know, when they have time off, and then he comes, you know, down the aisle all mad, and everybody's like scatters, and, you know, so I think he felt he had to do that, because the other side of him was, he was like this master joke teller. He could tell a joke like nobody else. I mean, there's such a skill set to telling a joke, you know. It's about not, you know, there's nothing worse than when somebody like, who thinks they're a raconteur, start to tell a joke, and they do kind of, all right, so, and you're just like, oh my God, are you gonna fucking drag this thing out forever? But, like, he had this way of just kind of like, I think, bah, 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 because he's hurt so many, and I think he was a frustrated comedian too, performer.
Really?
I think he wanted to be a performer, yeah, yeah. And my mother did too, and I always feel like that's why, where my sense of humor comes from, is my mom loved really goofy humor. And then my dad really liked joke telling and really smarter kind of humor, although weirdly, like, he loved Benny Hill. He thought that was the funniest thing in the world. And he loved Laurel and Hardy. That was my fondest times when my dad was sitting there and just, like, laughing with him, because he had such a funny sense of humor, but it was also, he had a very, very, you know, judgmental sense of humor. He and my uncle both were always about this, when they'd be watching a show, or like a talk show or a comedian on a show, and, you know, they're getting laughs, and I thought they were funny. He's like, there was like, oh, they tell them to laugh. They must tell them to laugh, because that's not funny. And I was like, well, and that's where I started getting like, well, I have such a hatred of judgment, you know, especially of subjective things.
But do you think some of that was ingrained into you from seeing that, to where your dad helped you develop some sort of a self-critic with determining what's funny and setting a bar?
Well, it was a two-edged sword, because I fed off of what he thought was funny, and so wanted to kind of find things that he would think was funny in that way. But then I also hated the judgment that he would put on things. And I have a real problem with very judgmental people, because it was just in my family. It was always like, I hate the word why. And my father was always famous. Yeah, exactly. Why? Why used in this context? Why would they do that? Why does that guy want to be an actor? Why would he want to be, you know, a truck driver? It's like, because he's drawn to do it. He loves it for some reason. Why does that person want to be an artist? Because they want to.
It sounds like a judgmental question.
Oh, totally. My grandmother always got on this thing of, like, George Burns, like, George Burns, you know, he was, you know, however old he was, like, he and Bob Hope, they should just stop. They should retire. Why do they want to keep going on TV and doing this stuff? It's like, because that's what they do. Like, they will die if they don't do it. And because I was so driven to do what I wanted to do, that just those questions about, like, why would they do this? Why, you know, it's just like, you know, I think it was, for me, it was just like, I loved all entertainers and funny people and all that. So I was just like, I was just so happy they were doing it. And the idea that, oh my God, are there people out there judging and going, like, why should they be doing it? They shouldn't be doing that anymore, was so kind of eye-opening to me.
Right.
Why the internet's been a disaster for me, which we can go into later. But
well, I could see that for somebody who, you know, obviously reading about some of your experiences at school, there could be a judgment that can maybe stop you from doing that. And that seems like almost a reaction to something that's scary. Because what if the question is, because they're not good enough?
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that hangs over everything in my life and everything in most people's lives. But for me, it's something I always think is going to get better, and it never gets better. It's everything is driven by fear in a weird way, and it's a fear that you're not going to be able to keep doing what you love to do. And that drives you every single moment of the day, and it can fuck you up really bad because it makes you overanalyze things, and yet you do need to overanalyze things. But you got to find that happy medium. That's why I always go back to when I created Freaks and Geeks. It was just like, I don't know if I would have tried to create Freaks and Geeks because I'd be like, I don't know, is there a market for high school stuff?
You would know too much.
I would know too much. And that's why I love new voices and new artists because they just come in with like, hey, here's what I'm doing. Whenever I lecture at film schools, I'm always like, look, I'm going to tell you all my rules. Take it with a complete grain of salt. Because I've had so many times in my career, people are like, oh, we can't do that. And so, okay, I won't do that. And then somebody else does that, and they have a giant hit with it.
Right.
And you're like, well, I thought we couldn't do that. Well, they could. It's like, well, why can they, you know? And it's like, oh, there's no rules. So, you know, but that's what I love about this business, too. You know, that's why I was terrible at math. Because, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, and there's no wiggle room.
Right.
You know, and in our business, like, I don't know, it could work, it couldn't work.
Well, before we get off the subject of upbringing, and, you know, one of the things that we're close enough in age that to be called a fag was the worst thing on earth for a boy in middle school. Mm-hmm. And you tell this story at the beginning of your book about the first day of middle school, a teacher mispronounces your name.
Yes.
And that sort of sealed your fate. And What made me curious about that is that I knew kids in school who were, and I count myself among this group, who were, you know, tortured pretty relentlessly.
Yeah.
For me, because I was tiny and unable to defend myself on any level. But I think for some people, they let it define them.
Oh, totally. I think it's pretty much everybody in the world. And we pay the price for whatever torture or bad thing they went through. I mean, my problem was, it's funny, you were a small kid. I was a tall kid. And so I was like a Goliath. And all my bullies were half my size. They were all these little short guys. But they were so fucking scary and tough. And, you know, I'm this, you know, gentle giant, quote unquote, kind of walking around. My only goal is like, I just want to make people laugh and like, I want to have a good time. So it was the combo of kind of these little bullies and just, you know, and especially in the locker room. I mean, you know, I hear the word locker room talk. All I hear is like me getting tortured.
Right.
You know, because it was just, that's where it would all come down. Because, you know, first of all, you're getting undressed, so what's worse when you're that age? You know, it's bad enough you're in a school with your clothes on, then suddenly you have to take your clothes off.
Right.
You know, God forbid you got to go in the fucking shower. I mean, I don't know why there's not laws against kids having to take showers in school. Then you got to go out and they make you fucking play dodgeball, which is basically says like, okay, all tough guys, just beat the shit out of these guys.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, what is bouncy balls? It's not bouncy balls. These things fucking hurt. And especially they would give out the little tiny ones that came in like softballs.
They were overinflated. So they
totally.
Were really, yeah.
And it was sanctioned like survival of the fittest. It's basically like, fellas, I know you can't legally beat these guys up out in the regular school, but in here you can. You know, and it's all under the guise of it's sport. You know, I remember the one time, like, I was sort of the last kid, and, like, somebody threw a ball, and I caught it, but out of just complete self-preservation, and then, you know, and then I knew they wanted to kill me, so I was like, just let myself get hit, and then they wouldn't hit me because they wanted to torture me longer, and then the gym teacher's like, all right, there's no boundaries now, so then they could just stalk in and fucking kill me. And it's just like, what world is this? What is this supposed to be teaching me? And I know, you know, from their perspective, it's supposed to toughen you up, you know, but everybody's not have to be toughened up. So then, and just to finish out on Jim, so then after all that, you got to go into and take off all your clothes and go into a shower with these guys. And I wouldn't do it. And then I got in trouble for it. And then the one time they made me go in there, then they dogpiled on me. And it's just like, which is the most like crazy, like what is the agenda in this shower? Like, what are you guys doing? You're supposed to be tough and you call me homophobic slurs and yet you're all jumping on top of me. And it's like, it was so upsetting and so like, I've never recovered from that. And that's why, you know, now that we're in sort of a world of what I consider to be empowered bullies at the moment, like my brain is just goes haywire. I can't kind of take it in. And, you know, that's why the internet's been such a disaster, because it's like the bullies that come in, it's literally like they've come into your house and they just hold you down and they're punching your head because, you know, you're like, oh my God, you're in my phone, you know?
Yeah. Does that bring you back to that sort of irrational?
Totally.
You know, it's funny when I talk to someone over a certain age about anything in terms of creative beginnings, there certainly is an age cutoff where you wonder about how the resistance created the art, because I do think that public school was way more of a gauntlet.
Yeah.
When we went there.
Yeah, we were not part of the self-esteem movement.
No.
This is the tear down your self-esteem movement.
It was tear down your self-esteem, and the parents were sort of in their own world. But what was the effect on you of having to go back and look at your adolescence in such detail?
Well, it was a slow road to it, because it started when I moved out to L.A., you know, because I got a clean slate, you know, so nobody knows who you were. You know, I was 17 years old, but I was just so driven. So I just cold called all the studios from my house in Michigan saying, like, do you need actors? And they're like, no, we need CPAs and, you know, lawyers. But then when I got to the very end of the list, it was Universal Studios, and they were like, well, we need tour guides. So I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, he goes, well, you gotta get here in 2 days, because that's when the you know, when we're doing the audition. And so I had my finals that next day, and so I did my finals, got in the car with my next door neighbor, and we just drove straight through to LA from Michigan and got here just in time. And they liked me, and so they put me into the training program. And then
God,
I
talk about, like, just straight to the epicenter of the dream, right?
You know, it's like, because my dad's like, well, no, you can start here, and then you can make, you know, there's a company called Jam Handy. They made industrials. He's like, oh, you don't have to go out there. You can probably be an actor in these industrials, you know, for Jam Handy. I was like, I don't know if I want to try to conquer Detroit. If I'm going to put all this time into it, I'm going to fucking go to where it is,
right,
and see if I can do it. There was a show called Make Me Laugh.
Yeah.
That was the kind of where, you know, three comedians try to make somebody laugh and you get points. It was a game show, but it was really about stand-up. And Mike Binder had become one of the regulars on there, and he was hilarious, but like, it was like, oh no, he's from Detroit, so it can be done. So that gave me the whole idea to come out. And also, I really just wanted to flee my bullies, I think. I mean, whether I was gonna run into them again or not, I don't know. It just, I'm like, what is this? The world can't be like this. It can't be this bad. You know, so I always look at like Los Angeles and Hollywood, like, it's gotta be better out there. I mean, that's where artists live, and that's where funny people and actors and successful people live. So I gotta get there, because I wanna get into showbiz, and this is the way to do it. And I came out with a head full of steam to be a tour guide. Then I found out about USC Film School, got into USC Film School. And when I first went to LA, it was just like, oh, this is gonna be like a fun exploratory thing. This was like, now I'm moving away. And I was an only child, and I was close to my parents. And I remember like just going into this tailspin of like, I'm leaving, and like suddenly my cat is like, oh, I'm gonna never see my cat again. And my mom was gonna drive out with me, and I remember like getting in the car to drive, and I just started crying, you know, at 18 years old, I'm just crying in the car, and my mom, you know, we started to pull out, and I stop, and my dad's and the driver like, what's going on? Looking at my mom, and my mom does this. She goes like, and I was like, and then I was like so insulted by that, as like this cartoon version of me being some crybaby and stuff. But I couldn't break out of it. And the whole time we were driving, we got, you know, I was just despondent. And we got to LA, and I just had a meltdown. I was just like, I can't. I was supposed to move in with this friend of mine who was a tour guide. And we got here, I was like, Ma, I gotta go home. I can't stay here.
You were terrified.
Yeah, I was terrified. And so we got in the car and went home, which was the biggest feeling of failure I've ever felt in my life, of just like, I caved, I fell apart. And even my father goes like, never be afraid of change, never be afraid. He's like lecturing me, he didn't want me to leave, he wanted me to take over his store, but he was more horrified by the fact that I just shit all over my dreams, you know, and just came back because I was afraid. And he was a good enough guy to go, you're not going to be happy taking over this store. I would love nothing more for you to take over this store, because you're the heir apparent to the store, but you'll be miserable and you want to do that. And so he's really the one that kind of sent me back out.
So how did it start to dawn on you that maybe you were more of a storyteller, or maybe there was something inside you that could see performance better than you could perform?
It took a long time. I mean, the weird thing was, I always wanted to be doing the writing and directing, but as an actor, That's why I went, honestly, that's why I went to film school. My whole reason for going to film school was, oh, it'll make me a better actor. Because if I know, you know, A, I'll work towards my Woody Allen dream of writing and directing my own stuff, but I'll also be more effective on camera because I'll know, oh, this is what that shot does, and that's why the lens is there, and maybe I can play the lens more. But then I was always writing. I was always writing what I would hope would be my own vehicles, and then once I, you know, then I was doing stand-up, which is, that's the ultimate, you're writing for yourself. So that kind of kept it going, and then I transitioned out of stand-up when I started losing, you know, losing the fun of it, into acting. And they had like a 15-year, you know, very good career as a character actor, you know, being the sixth lead on TV shows. But then in that case, I would always pal around with the writers, get to know them, and then I would always write an episode of whatever show I was on and give it to them, and they'd give me notes, and they usually really liked what I wrote. But then the show would get canceled because, you know, no show I was on ever went more than a season. And so then I just reset and again and write another episode for the next show I was on. I was always writing, but just, you know, it wasn't going anywhere, but I was just kind of learning. So by the time I did Freaks and Geeks, that was right when I decided I was going to stop acting, because I'd been a regular on four TV series, and then I finally got on Sabrina the Teenage Witch as her biology teacher, Mr. Poole, and it was a hit. Finally, I was on a hit show, and I was like, oh my God, I finally did it. I'm going to be taken care of for 7 years. I'll show up. They'll cut my hair. They'll give me clothes to wear. They'll tell me what to say. It's right by my house. It was the greatest thing ever. Do a first year on that. Take all my money, put it into this low-budget film that I'm going to make and direct and star in. And then once I shoot that, I get a call, oh, we're writing another show. But it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me because it kicked me out of the nest. So I remember the big moment for me was I went to an audition for Mama's Family. And I'm sitting in the waiting room, and Michael McKean is waiting to read for the same role. And he's one of my heroes, well, a comic hero. And I'm just like, oh, my God. Here I am. Michael McKean has to audition for Mama's Family, you know, and I'm just like, and all I can see is like, and he's talented, so he's going to get the job. This is my future. Like, I'm just going to be auditioning against people who are more talented than me and more famous than me for, you know, crummy roles. And it's like, I got to get out of this. And then piling on top of that, once, you know, I took the money, like I said, from my first season on Sabrina and put it all into this low-budget feature that I wrote and directed and starred in. But still putting it together, I was going to, you know, try to get on the festival circuit. But then I had an audition for, they were going to do Honey, I Shrunk the Kids as a series.
Right.
And John Landis was going to, you know, direct the pilot. And so I went in, you know, and John, you know, I was a big fan of Blues Brothers, my favorite movie, and Animal House and all these things. So like, I go and have this meeting with John Landis, and he's like, "So hey, I see you just directed a movie." "Yes." So we go on this 10-minute, like, two directors talking, and it was the greatest thing. I was like, "Oh my God, he's one of a guy who made movies that I love." And then he goes, so then, you know, after 10 minutes he goes like, "Okay, so you're going to read for us." And the come down for me was just like, oh no, now I'm that guy again. I'm just an actor who's looking for a job, and I may or may not get it. And, you know, I did the audition. I wasn't even very good.
You had a glimpse of the room.
Totally. I was like, I want to be that. I want to be that. I want to be the director. I want to be in charge and be able to be a peer with these people, you know. And so that was the final thing. And then the final thing was, and this is such a terrible story. I'd already kind of transitioned out, but then Drew Carey asked me to do this like little two-line part on the Drew Carey show. So I get there, and they put me in this like dressing room that's like a pen. They used to have these old dressing rooms. They were just like standalone
right things,
and they had no bathroom or anything. And I was like, I was kind of sick that day, and so I go in like, where's the bathroom? And I go into the stage, and there's like this bathroom. So I go into the bathroom, and I totally befoul the bathroom. I mean, it's like, you know, horrendous evacuation in there, you know, and just like, oh. So I like leave, you know, I go back to my room, and I come back in, and there's a like a sign on the door, so please do not take a shit in this bathroom. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done with being an actor now.
Literally, the straw that broke the camel's back was
a horrendous shit. Exactly.
There wasn't enough dignity.
Like, totally. It's like, I thought I was at a point where I could at least get my own bathroom, and now I've literally got people mad
after
at me.
After 20 years of working at this career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all comes down to this.
Yeah, well, you know what? No, but I think that
the most valuable shit of my life.
That's right.
Thank you. You're welcome. You're welcome.
In telling these stories, you realize how many tributaries and how many detours and U-turns you have to take. Yeah. Even when you have, you know, a fully formed imagination and you work hard, it takes so long to be able to find the thing that you're supposed to be doing.
But the irony is that I don't think you ever truly find your voice. You just kind of find what your tone is.
Yeah.
Because your voice is changing constantly because you're having to go into different genres, or if you choose to. I choose to go into different genres. I mean, there's some people that just kind of will write sort of the same things, about the same thing all the time.
That's interesting, because I do like the fact that, you know, when I go to see a film, I don't want to know what it's going to be just because I know who directed it.
Yeah.
Or just because I know who produced it. The filmmakers I really like, they are restless enough and willing enough to fail at something to keep themselves interested.
Yeah,
right?
100%.
Rather than, oh, this is my brand and I'm gonna keep making it because people keep buying it, right?
Totally. And, but then the other side of that is people who try to change it up so much. I never wanted to like penalize people for liking me. So even though like with my movies, I like to pick different genres, I want them to be funny and I still want my voice in there somewhere.
Yes.
You know, but I just want the context to be different, and the tone can be different totally, but I worked the hardest to put humor in there wherever I could, and you do these, you know, screenings with audiences, and I would just sit there, like, waiting for, like, when's the next laugh, because that's the only way I could judge if they were still engaged, like, okay, they laughed at that joke, okay, the next joke's 10 minutes from now, let's see if they laugh at that, you know, humorous moment or light moment.
Right.
So that's, I can only judge stuff from that. I couldn't make a heavy drama because I would just sit there with a test audience going like, are they into it? You know, if they get up and leave, you know, then I go, okay, they're not into it, but.
That is a funny thing because I think that's almost a stand-up perspective of,
totally.
Are they laughing throughout?
Yeah, I make movies like a stand-up comedian. You know, stand-up, you go to like open mic nights or go to the club and like test out your material and go, okay, I got to punch that up. You'd record it and then you'd listen back and go, okay, that didn't get a laugh and change that. That's me on the set, you know, let's take 10 jokes in and all right, let's do all these different jokes. And then when we go to our, you know, put together our first assembly of the movie with the jokes we think are the funniest, and then we do a test screening, you know, with an audience that we don't know, 300 people recruited off the street, record the laughs, and put it up. And the first time you're like, I hope they even like the movie. But then you also go like, okay, well, they laughed at that. Okay, they didn't laugh at that. Okay, let's go in the editing and let's change these jokes out. And I build it exactly like my stand-up.
There's no way to write stand-up without taking it out and putting it in front of people. You can't write stand-up in a vacuum.
Totally.
And you're saying that you can't make those, your movies, you can't make them without an audience.
No.
Coming in, and that's interesting.
Well, especially when you're working with a studio, and it's the, anybody who's, especially if you're trying to make a comedy, who's doesn't embrace test screenings, you're just making your life absolutely miserable because there's nothing worse than arguing with the people in charge over whether a joke is funny or not.
Right.
You know, and you're like, I think it's funny. Well, we don't think it's funny. Well, I think it's, you know, like, you're just test screening. You know, they go, we don't think that's funny. And I play the tape back and go like, no, they didn't laugh. I guess you're right. Or they go, that's not funny. I go, listen. And like, it destroys, like, there's no argument anymore. So why would you not have that empirical evidence?
Right. When I think of your films, and especially, you know, there's certainly the through line of the films you've made with female protagonists, Bridesmaids, Spy, Ghostbusters, where there's a lot of layers to real relationships. And it's almost like, yes, they're really funny, but there is a philosophy or a moral code in there. And you're making films that are also advancing this idea that these stories should be out there, right? And it's funny to hear you say you build it like a stand-up and build it based around laughs, because there's also, I'm sure, quite a bit of subversive desire to undermine stereotypes and undermine expectations of what a film could do well. And I'm sure you did not have any concrete evidence that Bridesmaids was going to blow up the way it did.
No.
But at the same time, I would assume there's got to be some kind of satisfaction in sticking to your vision of what the story can be.
Look, you have Everybody's got certain filters you run things through that you want to do. And for me, all I ever ask of anything is that it ultimately be good-natured. Even if it can get super dark and get super weird and all that, but if the end result, I never want the message to be like, people suck, you know?
Well, I think that's the point of Bridesmaids, is that you care enough about each character that they don't have to be placed into their black and white stereotypes that, oh, yeah. Protagonist, antagonist. Yeah. And I think that's something you've contributed to sort of a more mainstream genre, like films that do really big box office, but still have the nuance of character that we're not as divisive of human beings that our stories have to be, oh, that's the bad person, that's the good person.
Yeah.
And I don't know, if that's female-centric thinking, or if it's, do you know what I mean?
I know, it's an interesting point because, you know, really heavy testosterone movies tend to be like, you know, just kind of like...
He good, he bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I've always hated that. I've always had this real issue with making the audience judge and jury. And that's why, like, I always hated them, like, the action movies of the 80s especially, because it's always like, here's our hero, and now here's the bad guy, and now the bad guy's going to do something so horrible to, like, an innocent person that now we're like, well, then fucking kill that guy.
Yes.
Tear his head off. You know, because you're like, well, you're a monster if you don't want this guy to get killed. But it's like, but to have to suffer through the innocent person getting killed is just like, it's so demoralizing to me.
Right.
It's like, this is not entertaining. I feel terrible. All I can think about is that poor person. And yes, now I hate the villain, but, you know, I don't like that kind of thing. And so for me, I always say, I just want to tell small stories in a big way.
Yeah.
You know, it's what's the germ of a story. It's like, find that thing that is about you. And it could be a tiny thing. It's about a movie about a breakup. You know, I had this terrible breakup. Okay, that's great. But now how can you write it large, you know, if you want to have a commercial movie? I mean, definitely tell the small story if you want to, and that's what the budget you have or that's what you're able to do. But if you want to make a big movie, let it be a small movie that is a big movie.
Brings up a question about how you sort of shepherd your ideas through, if you have a little spark of an idea. Have you developed a process for how to sort of validate an idea?
It's all gut, you know.
It is.
Yeah, and it's the hardest part of the process because
you're not short for ideas, right?
No, I have a million ideas.
How do you organize all those?
Well, you write them down, you have them, but what you realize very quickly is that ideas are only ideas. They you know, they're, I mean, that's why, you know, like, Twitter's fun, because you go, oh, I had an idea, and boom, and I'll put it out as a joke or a thought, and like, okay, there it goes, and, you know, send it off on its way. And that's what your notebooks are mostly filled with, like, it could be this, go, what about
your notebooks
this?
Are filled with tweets that you didn't
Yeah, exactly, have. Sometimes. I mean, that's honestly, that's the old notebook. That's, Twitter is just what our comic notebooks used to be of, like,
But then how do you look at all those sentences in your notebook and go, that's the one I'm going to explore?
It's what you go, you run it through several layers. First is like, does anybody really give a shit about this? Which is the hardest question in the world to ask. The litmus test for me.
Back to your why question.
Well, yeah, exactly, why. But I think it's a good why. Which is, I look at it this way. I go, okay, if I saw a trailer for this idea, and I don't know me, would I go like, hey, I want to see that? Kind of an undeniable idea. And that's all you look for, is what's an undeniable idea. But then, you have to look at the high concept, you know, the idea of high concept, which is something you can say in a log line, and people go like, oh my God, what a great idea. Those are the hardest movies to pull off, writing-wise, because you have to string that out for 2 hours, you know, and it's like why trailers are so kind of unfair, because, you know, the greatest trailer in the world, how many times have you seen the greatest trailer in the world,
right.
And you see the movie, and you're like, oh my God. But to be able to sit down, and that's why, as a writer, it really holds your feet to the fire, because I've had a million times I've started, I mean, in the last 2 years alone, like, this is going to be great. And I get 30 pages in, yeah, this is rocking. And then like, and just like hit the cliff is like, what do we do next? You know, and there's nothing
really
there.
And so you'll get even 30 pages into a script before you go.
Oh, yeah.
And what is the sign that you're not going to finish it?
I don't think I can string this out. I don't know what happens. I don't know if what happens next is compelling enough. I don't know if I am even enjoying being with these characters anymore. I think I'm tired of this character, or I can't think of enough complications or forward motion for this person. I mean, it's, one of my problems as a writer is I have a really hard time, like, outlining. You know, and I've done times where I've done heavy outlines and heavy treatments and all that, but I tend to not stick to them anyway. I'm so much into the character that I can't, in an outline situation, like predict a line that somebody's going to say to somebody in a moment, that then I go like, oh shit, and then I can spin this off this way. Like, I can't predict that when I'm in the outline mode. And so that's why I like to kind of start writing, because I like get going like, oh, you know, this just happened, the script I'm writing right now. And it just like, this weekend I had so much fun, because like I knew exactly where I was going to go with it. And then I had this one funny interaction. I was like, oh my God. And it just took it complete opposite
way.
How
do you know whether to entertain that or whether to, you know, because—
Well, you don't. You live on the tightrope the whole time, because you're going like, because that's the thing, as you're writing, you're like, oh boy, did I just derail this 30 pages down the road? I don't know. But if an idea is strong enough, then you'll just kind of keep— I always used to term it like, whenever I'm writing, I feel like I put on a helmet, there's a brick wall, and I run at the, and I hit the wall, and I back up, and I hit it again, and you just keep doing it. And to me, that's what that is, in writing-wise, is like, I'll write these for first 15 pages. Now I'm going to sit down, I'm going to read through these 15 pages, and then I'm going to take, now I'm going to write the next, you know. And so you kind of keep, like, as an audience, you're going like running up and like, oh, and now, and it keeps taking you past. And then, but it's a lot of extra work. It's— every writing teacher would just call me crazy for doing it that
way.
But
you have to enjoy doing that, right?
I do, yeah. And what I like about it is then I'm writing as an audience member, because I'm going how is he going to get out of this? And so if I can, I'll go like, how am I going to get out of this? But that's what's fun, because then you're like, oh, okay, yeah, this would happen. And then it kind of— it keeps you, you know, it keeps you going for that first draft.
Right.
It's like, you know, when I wrote the movie Spy, it was just so fun when she, you know, accidentally kills her first guy.
Yes.
She throws up.
Yes.
Because I was like, if I killed somebody, I would throw up. I mean, there's no way I would not. And then that—
you know what's funny about that is that was a totally original moment. And if you were going by the theory of what happens next in movies, mm-hmm. you would have never have found that, because we haven't seen that.
Right. She'd say a pithy line or something, you know, like something.
Right.
Something that wouldn't resonate. But that's, you know, that's the kind of writing I want to do. I want to do the projects where, as an audience member, you're like, that's me. I would do that. Or, oh my God, I wouldn't have thought to do that, but maybe I would have, because that's me, you know. And that's why I think Melissa's is such a great, you know, lead actress, because, you know, everybody relates to her, you know, and that's why I love this new movie I do with Anna Kendrick. Like, Anna just feels like—
Yes.
one of us, you know, and that's what's so— that's the fun.
Do you ever worry about, oh, I'm writing women, I need to know a different perspective, or I need to check in with somebody? Like, do you ever feel like, oh, I don't have the right to, or I don't have enough information to know how to write a reaction here?
Constantly. Oh,
you
my
do?
God, constantly. Yeah, I mean, that's—
how do you deal with that?
I'm surrounded by women. I'm surrounded by women who vet my work. First of all, my wife will not hold back and tell me, you know, very honestly what she thinks of anything. My producing partner, Jesse Henderson, she is, you know, one of my toughest critics, and she will call me out on stuff. But I deputize everybody to do that. It's like, please tell me, all the women around me, please tell me if this is fake, if this is a man's version of what you would do.
So you acknowledge that there is that.
Oh, yeah, I can't. I mean, look, I'm still a guy, you know, and I'm still going to process things that way. But what I've found is, you know, I have enough of a perspective where I get close, but then it's really, I mean, everybody has to vet me, but we're not that far apart. It's just kind of how we express ourselves—
Right.
is different. You know, look, when I— Bridesmaids, any of those things, I always say, like, to the actors, like, how is this what you would do? And that's why, I mean, honestly, that's where that's where all this has to go towards. And that's why we need, you know, 50-50 parity on the sets and all that. You need everybody vetting everybody. Because I've seen movies that have been made by all women, and the male characters are terrible, you know? So it's like, so you want everybody calling everybody on stuff, because then you get these honest portrayals of everyone, you know, male and female and all diversities and all that. But you need to have all the people who have the perspective there to weigh in. You know, there's nothing worse than, it's like, you know, a bunch of guys like, yeah, I think the ladies would say, you know, it's like,
yeah.
No, it's not going to work.
Well, your new film, Simple Favor, Anna Kendrick, Blake Lively, unlike a film like, say, Spy, where— and I think Bridesmaids has this quality too, where you allow scenes to play out to absurdity. And I think there's some of that in the wedding dress shop—
Yeah.
scene in Bridesmaids. And yet, in this new film, and I think it's because it's maybe— there's some more constraints to the genre of thriller and everything. The editing is very taut, and there's tension, and there's an economy of dialogue, of action, everything to serve the story.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had a love of this sort of genre that you haven't been able to explore fully before this, and what your trepidation was about trying this, and if it was a new cinematic language that you had to learn.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love thrillers. I mean, most of what I watch on television are dramas and that kind of thing.
That's so funny.
It's funny, and it's for no reason other than, I guess I'm not drawn to watching a lot of comedy just because it's what I do. And because I mean, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, you know, when I start writing a script, I write it as a drama. Like we story it out like a drama, no matter.
Even like Spy.
Yeah, totally. Because like I got to write like a real spy movie. Like I want the motivations to be right in this. If you're just going joke to joke, you're dead. I mean, people will fall asleep in a half an hour. I mean, unless those jokes are just hilarious. But even then, there's got to be something that pulls you through, at least for me. And so my favorite director was Howard Hawks, because he did a million different genres, and he did them all amazing. I mean, the guy's from Scarface, and then he's doing like these amazing westerns. Then he does Bringing Up Baby, you know, I mean, which are in His Girl Friday, two of the funniest movies in my opinion. And he did it kind of effortlessly. And so I've been desperately looking for like a thriller, a Hitchcockian kind of thing, but I don't know how to write that. That's not my skill set, really, to write that. And the script showed up that the studio wanted us to produce. Jesse and I to produce, and she brought it, and she goes like, "This is a really good script. You should read this." I read it, and I was like, "I want to direct this," you know. And nobody kind of expected that, but here's the thing: it's like, if it was just like a straight thriller, I don't know if I would have gone for it. But Anna Kendrick's character, of this mom, this nerdy mom who has this mommy vlog, and she's kind of earnestly trying to do the right thing, and all the other moms and parents think she's an idiot.
There's an earnestness to her. Now that you've said it, I feel like that's where that character fits into your canon of worldview.
Totally. Yeah, it's a revenge of the nerd. I mean, she is this nerdy mom who befriends the coolest mom in school, and then, you know, has to figure things out and kind of find her inner strength and be a badass at the end.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, if you, even though my movies seem kind of like they're all over the place, there's always a threat.
Yeah, no, I think that's so interesting. And when you put it that way, I would assume that probably also made it less intimidating for you.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because I would assume that there are different places to put a camera in a film like this, or a different cinematic language to learn.
Sometimes with my comedies, I'll feel like we don't get to be as cinematic as I would like to be, just because, you know, the audience, they want the laughs, and they want the characters, and they want the faces first and foremost, and then you can kind of layer your stuff in there. You know, in Spy, was the first time I really got to start playing more with the camera and all that. But this one, I just had a lot more freedoms to really kind of play with the genre, because when you're doing something like this, it's the framing as much as the writing and as the performances.
It is.
It tells
very
the
much.
Story.
Yeah.
I call it suburban noir, and we just got hung up on that. Like, let's shoot suburban noir, where it's kind of like nicely lit, really friendly.
Yes, it is
places.
Open lit.
Yeah.
But it has very dark elements to it, even in the framing and the.
Which makes it even scarier to
yes.
me. I mean, to me,
or
it's
more unsettling.
Yeah, like the banality of evil. I'm always fascinated by that idea, because it is like, you know. Everything looks, you know, movies present like, oh, you know, when something bad's going to happen, it's really dark, lit and ominous. But we look at things on the news and stuff that happens in other countries, horrible massacres, and go massacres and stuff like that. You go like, that happens like in bright daylight.
Well, it's interesting when you say that, because when you say that in your comedies, you're sort of serving the master of comedy in terms of, you know, going back to a bridesmaid scene of, you know, one woman throwing up on another woman's head, the camera can really only go in one place there to get the maximum amount of funny.
Yeah, but there it's funny because Kristen was very nervous about that scene because, you know, that Judd and I, when we were all working on the rewrites, were like, it was written different. Originally, it was more, she has this fantasy about her in this dress. It was very funny, but it was, we were both kind of like, we need a big event here. Something needs to really happen. And it's not so much that it's shitting and pissing, you know, and throwing up or whatever. It's that the idea of everything's going wrong and everybody's trying to pretend everything's fine. That's why it's funny. It's not because of all the stuff. It's the outcome of.
Yes.
But then once it happens, then it has to happen. But I mean, we overshot that. I mean, we had a whole thing where poor one of the characters goes running down this hallway, and she like goes into this room. She thinks it's another bathroom, and she projectile vomits across the room, and it's actually the woman who owns the dress shop's all white office, and like the vomit goes all over her, you know, wedding picture with her husband. So we shot all this extra stuff, but knowing like, okay, we're gonna get it all. I remember saying to Kristen, like, look, we're gonna shoot a lot of stuff, but we're only gonna use what works, you know. And that was through the process of, you know, 9 or 10 test screenings of like, let's go too far, let's go not enough, and you start to see like, oh, okay, until you find like the right math on it, you know. But you do have to go for it.
It's interesting the confidence it takes to be able to shoot extra stuff, to be able to say we don't know, and I guess to be comfortable in no matter what room you're in. Was that sort of your vision quest?
What you think your vision quest going in is that I have to know everything, and I have to be an expert on everything, and I have to just have the answer for everything. And when you first start out, it's like, don't tell me this. I know this. How dare you? You know, you don't get it. It's in my head, blah, 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 blah. And say these lines like, no, I worked a year and a half on this script. Say these lines exactly as I wrote them, and you better blah, 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 blah. And sometimes you put it together and you go like, yeah, that's fantastic. What a genius I am. But most of the time you're like, that could have been better, you know. And the thing about it is that, like, if you're going to hire talented people, get their ideas. Get, you know, you're the director. First of all, you're the ringmaster, so you're going to get credit for it, you know, anyway. But on top of that, it's like, why would you cut off this fountain of creativity around you? You know, I won't mention any names, but there's a comedic actress who I love, and she went off to do this movie with another comedic actor friend of mine who's brilliant, and it was with this writer-director I know who's brilliant, but very, you know, in a box. And I said, boy, that must have been so much fun working with all them. And she goes, it was a nightmare. So he wouldn't let us deviate one line, one word from the dialogue. We had it, and I was like, why would you possibly hire these two known for their inventive, creative voices, and then make them stick to a script? It just seems crazy. Like, you know, I've had so many times, because I encourage, you know, over the years I've loosened up, encourage people to, like, take their improv, do their thing, try, surprise me this, blah, 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 blah. And so many times, somebody will do something, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. But it's like, but I never want to cut off somebody's creativity, because I was an actor. Sometimes directors be like, what are you doing? Don't, you know, and like freeze up. So I'm like, you know, like, just whatever happens, go like, awesome, we got that, let's try this, you know. And so many times I'll get in the editing room and that take that I thought was the worst ends up in the movie.
Why do you think that just distance and time and seeing it in the edit room, what changes so much that you couldn't see it on the day?
On the day, you've got one thing in your head, which is exactly how I saw this when I wrote it, when I read it, when I storyboarded it, whatever. It has to be this. And so here comes this actor in with this in the moment. They're the human having to make this happen. And they say it how it feels natural to them. And you're like, that's not what. No, it's got to be like this. You know, when I was a TV director, I had such bad experiences occasionally, because you work with certain showrunners who just like, the joke has to be this. And I'd be working with like really talented, inventive people, and they'd say a joke a different way. And to me, it was really funny. I'm like, oh my God, that's hilarious. And I go back to the monitor and they're like, no, he's got to say it like this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going back and forth like, can you put the emphasis on this? And then it's like, what the fuck are we doing? You know, like, I'm trying to shove his words into your mouth and you're not, so now nobody's funny. So when you're on the set, you constantly think you're compromising. You're constantly going like, oh, my vision. Oh, it was supposed to be this. Oh, that joke was supposed to be this. And you realize, no, now it belongs to them.
Right.
And even if it's just changing up a word sometimes, you know, or an attitude, but you get so, it's just, I mean, that's the biggest thing I want to like break every filmmaker of, is just that insane desire to control everything. You are controlling everything. You are. You're in the editing. You've got all this footage. And when you're on the set, have them do it a million different ways, you know. Let them do their thing, because once you let them do their thing, then they're going to be more willing to try your thing. One director I know, I can't remember her name, but she directed Kung Fu Panda 2, but we did a panel together, and she said, when you sit down to watch your movie, it's just like a Gatling gun of pain, because, like, everything's just flying at you. You're like, that's not right, that's not right, that's, you know, and that's what it is, but that's the first time you're seeing somebody else's version of your, what you did. And it's not to say they're right. I mean, there's, you know, plenty of times you go, like, all right, here, you didn't understand this. And they're like, oh, I get it. But then it becomes a different thing. Then it becomes about the actors, the people, all the humans who did it now have had their hands on it and have their input on it and made it better.
Right.
And so you've got to ride that wave. And again, going back to the test screenings, that's why I like the test screenings, because then, before I fall in love with anything, I'll try to do it as fast as I can. I mean, 3 or 4 weeks into my editing process is like, let's do a test screening. I think this works. You know, it's kind of like, I think it works.
Yeah, what's the point of finessing it before you
don't
even...
I mean, you get it, so you go
back,
like,
to your stand-up.
Yeah, exactly. You go like, yeah, I'm not going to present something that's horrendous, you know, but like, let's get it to a point where it's not, you know, 3 hours long, you know, but where I think this is right, and you go like, I think this works. Let's see. But you have to go into it going like, I think this works. Let's see if this works. Because if you take your entire DGA, you know, given 10-week period to fine-tune everything, by the time you put it in front of that audience, you're just like, oh, they don't get it. Oh, fuck these people. No, that's good. Oh, they don't know what they're talking about. And because you fall in love with everything. So you can't allow yourself to fall in love with everything. You have to go... You just have to look at, like, let's see if this works. I mean, that should be written on everybody's avid. Because I always say, the big, you know, outside of keeping things on schedule and getting the shots right and all that stuff, your biggest job as a director is to create a safe environment for your actors in which they can feel like they can do anything. Because I, again, going back, when I was an actor, I had sets where I did not feel safe. I, you know, not in a threatening way, but just as creatively, you know, you try something like, no! What are you doing? That's terrible. It's like... Oh my God, the minute you tell somebody whose heart and soul is completely exposed as an actor, like, that's terrible, they're gonna shut down. I know that, you know, there's plenty of directors who like to rule through terror, but I just, I can't work that way. I can't be around that. And I don't think it brings out the best in anybody. I don't think it brings out the best in your crew. I don't think it brings out the best in your, you know, the writers around you. I don't think it's good.
Sounds like you have a sensitivity towards being empathetic towards other people's plights. Yeah. And by going through all those stages, doing stand-up, doing acting, it sounds like you were sort of doing 35, 40 years of training to be able to direct, but that every experience you had was sort of leading up to this sort of the process that you now use that gets great performances out of people.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, look, I'm first to admit, I'm way too sensitive. You know, I think it's always been a hindrance in my life, but it's also led me to where I am. So I'm like, you know what, I just gotta go with it. But, you know, it's why I'm so sensitive to anybody feeling bad about themselves, almost to a fault. I mean, I call it like, it's like catastrophic empathy, you know, because you're like, I can't function in the real world sometimes. Like, I have to make sure nobody's upset or I'm not, you know, making anybody feel bad about themselves. But I'd rather be that than, you know, be a bully. And I think from what I do, it does work. And, you know, I've had times where I go like, why can't I be one of these crazy directors? Because, you know, these stories, like, people get away with everything. And you're like, why can't I, I think I can count on my hand a few times that I've, like, you know, had like a moment on the set or whatever. And people don't even take it seriously. Like, I always think like, oh, if you don't do it when you finally blow up, they're really going to, and it's like, no, they just go, oh, okay. It doesn't work.
You can't hide your true nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I spend so much energy on a set trying to keep everybody else happy, but I don't mind because then I'm happy because I get what I want out of the project. And, you know, even when I did this, one of my bomb movies, a little thing called Unaccompanied Minors, which is this Christmas movie. And we had all these kids, and I remember we had this scene in this room. It was like a holding pen for like 100 kids in this Unaccompanied Minors room. And the kids were just going crazy and all this stuff. And everybody's like, you gotta, you know, everybody wanted to like crack down on the kids. I said, like, don't crack down, let the kids be kids. Because when I turn on the camera, I want that energy there. I don't want them like, you know, I remember one point, like, some people always do this, like, whether they're with a boom operator, and like, he goes like, quiet, like, screams, and I mean, like, goes silent. And I was like, don't ever fucking do that again, because I hate that shit. And also, it's like, I want these kids, like, suddenly on, you know, they're afraid of being themselves. You're capturing lightning in a bottle, and whatever you can do to make that moment when the camera turns on and somebody does something, and if it's great, it's there forever, you know? And that's all I really care about. That's why I've, as much as I love theater, I'm much more drawn towards movies, because to me, the theater is like, you gotta get it right every night. For me, it's like, if I con a performance out of somebody, I'm so happy, you know? You're right. Like, they suddenly do something, you're like, oh my God, you just did something. Like, what did I do? It's like, don't worry about it. You did it, and I got it.
This is why I relate to your films, because there's an empathy there that comes through and makes for very human characters, no matter what the circumstances and how crazy it may be, like, you know, spy hanging from a helicopter.
Yeah.
There's humans in there, and it's why I fell in love with Freaks and Geeks, and it's why I wanted to meet you. And so thank you for going into it and you know, trying to dissect it for me and show me how it works, because your work is fascinating and I enjoy it.
Well, thank you, Sam. I appreciate it.
Hey, folks, that's our show. I love talking to Paul, and I think he's one of those filmmakers that is so smart and so collaborative that sometimes his brilliance sneaks up on you, and you think you're just there to be entertained, and you realize it's so much more. There are so many layers of depth in his films, and I would recommend you go back and watch Freaks and Geeks if you've never had that experience, because that show was ahead of its time, and it's so poignant and started the careers of so many actors that it's well worth checking out. Also, his new film, A Simple Favor, with Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick, is a revelation, and it's a thriller in the vein of Alfred Hitchcock, so you can't go wrong there. Also, check out his comedies Spy, Bridesmaids, and Ghostbusters. In fact, pretty much anything Paul gets his hands on, you'll enjoy. That's my recommendation to you. My other recommendation is to go to offcamera.com and find out just what we're all about. We are also a television show and a magazine, so if you haven't experienced watching Off Camera, the best way to do that is by seeing us on DirecTV's Audience Network, Channel 239. If you don't have the Audience Network, the next best thing is to go to our archive on our website, and for only $4.99 a month, you can have access to every episode we've ever made to watch as many times as you'd like on any device. That's right, we have over 155 episodes ready for you to watch, and you can delve into the whole archives and get a greater sense of what this whole project is about. Also, if you listen to us as a podcast but you haven't subscribed yet, please take a moment, go to the iTunes store, subscribe to us, and give us a rating and a review. Every time we get a rating and a review, it helps more people find out about the show. So if you love what we're doing, share it with the world, take a few minutes and give us those ratings. That would really help out. I want to thank everyone that helps us on the show: Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who I should say just got over a nasty bout of pink eye. So if you see him, make sure to wash your hands. Now, if you want to follow us on social media, that's easy. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. So if you have a guest suggestion or an idea, or you just want to talk about Off Camera with the world, social media is a great route to do that. And also, if you want to send me a personal email, I am sam@offcamera.com. And I love hearing from you. I love finding out what you're doing with your creative life. And I love getting suggestions. It's what makes the show more of a community. And I really encourage that. So if you love what we're doing, take a moment and reach out. And most importantly, be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor Chris Messina.
When I went into high school, it was, you know, ballerina boy, and they didn't understand that you wore tights, and I'd walk down the hallway and I'd have to get in the fights. I was like the Karate Kid meets Billy Elliot without the talent or the karate, you know? So they kept telling me I was not a part of this community. It was confusing, but it was also great. It gave me strength. And I was like, you know, ballerina boy is gonna do something, right? I'll show you.
If you've seen Chris Messina in HBO's Sharp Objects, you may think you have seen all of him. And that is true in a physical sense. But in our conversation, this versatile and talented everyman of an actor, known for his roles on The Newsroom, The Mindy Project, and Argo, delved deep into his past to reveal scars and struggles that he believes made him who he is today. And what that is an actor who longs to get dirty and who constantly questions his place in the industry. Chris illustrates just how idiosyncratic and often frustrating the job of an actor is, and he talks about his love of craft with sensitivity and grace. See you next time, off camera.